4. The next couple of years went along without excitement. Sallow and I swept the floors of the great house and went to our lessons daily. Nobody missed Toby, not even Tib, I think. Torm, mentally practicing the discipline of the swordsman, was sullen, aloof, and obedient in the classroom. Once or twice, when his impatience with the lessons or the teacher threatened to overcome him, he excused himself and left. Yavin was mostly away with the army. Itra had no ongoing war at that time, so young officers like Yavin were trained in exercises and drills or put on guard duty at the borders. Now and then he was sent home on leave, looking very fit and cheerful. We went both of those summers to the Venta farm, and there, too, were no great doings, just the lazy, ordinary happiness of being there. Yavin didn't come with us. He spent the first summer in training, and during the second he accompanied the father on a diplomatic mission to Galak. Torm spent both summers at the School of Swordsmanship, so Astano was our leader. She led us to Sentos Hill the very first evening. That was a shock and a grief at first, for we found it almost in ruins. The moat had silted up with winter rains, the earthwork behind the palisade had slipped. The palisade itself had been torn down in several places, and the rock piles that formed the tower and the gates had been knocked apart, not by weather, but by human malice.
"Those filthy peasants!"
Tib growled. He could growl now. His voice was changing. We all moped about the dilapidated place a while, feeling the same hateful, shameful contempt for the farm children we'd felt when they threw stones at us, and mourning the defilement of our city of dreams. But Astano and Sotur took heart, discussing how easily we could restore the palisade, and beginning even in the dusk to pile up rocks for the tower again. So we went back to the house, set out our pallets under the stars, and lay planning the rebuilding of Sentos. Sotur said,
"You know, if we could get some of them to help, to work on it, they might not hate it."
"Ugh, I don't want any of them around,"
said Riss.
"They're foul."
"One couldn't trust them," said Uter, who was less skinny and bony this summer, but no less prim.
"The one with the Jenny was all right,"
his sister Yumo said.
"Komi,"
Astano said.
"Yes, he was nice. Remember when he sang?"
We all lay remembering that golden, mysterious evening on the summit of the hills.
"We'd have to ask the foreman,"
Astano said to Sotur, and they briefly discussed the chances of getting any farm slave released to us.
"Only if we said they were to work for us," Sotur said,
and Astano replied,
"Well, they would. We worked as hard as any of them do. Digging that moat was awful, and we never could have done it without Yavin."
"But it would be different," Sotur said, "giving orders."
Astano said,
"Yes."
And there they left it. The idea was not mentioned again. We rebuilt Sentos, even if not to Yavin's or Avera's standards. And when it was rebuilt, we held a ceremony of purification, circling the walls within, not in mockery, but as it was described in Garrow's poem, with our teacher leading the procession as the high priest and lighting the sacred fire in the citadel. All summer, we often went to that hilltop as a group, or in pairs, or singly, all of us feeling it to be, amid all the wealth of woods and hills and streamside that the farm offered, our dearest place, our fortress and retreat. Aside from repairing Sentos, we had no great projects. We put on a few dance plays, but mostly what I remember is swimming with Tib in pools under the willows and alders, and lazing about in the shade talking, and going on long, desultory explorations of the woods south of the house. We did lessons for a half-morning daily with our teacher, and Riss and Sallow were often kept on for music lessons with Sotur and Yumo, for a singing teacher had come from Haramand.
Sotur's little niece, Yuta, had graduated from the tiny ones to run around with us, under Oko's particular care. And sometimes we took a whole batch of the older babies down to the stream and supervised the splashing and screaming and shrieking and sleeping, all through a long, hot afternoon. Sotur's aunts and the mother often joined us there, and sometimes Uter and Tib and I were sent away because the women and the older girls were going to bathe. Uter was convinced that the farm boys hid in the bushes to spy on them. He would patrol up and down officiously, ordering Tib and me to help him keep the vile brutes away from the women. Knowing the terrible punishment for such a transgression against the sacredness of the mother, I was sure the farm slaves would never come anywhere near our bathing pool. But Uter's mind ran on such things, fascinated by the idea of pollution. I was slow in my adolescence. To me, Uter's obsessions were as stupid as Tib's sniggering attempts at manly remarks about what you might see if you did hide in the bushes. I knew what women looked like. I'd lived in the women's quarters all my life. Just because Tib had been sent across to the men's barrack last winter, he acted as if there was something special about a woman with her clothes off. It was, I thought, incredibly childish. It had nothing to do with what I felt lately when I heard Sotur sing. That was entirely different. It had nothing to do with bodies. It was my soul that listened and was filled with pain and glory and unspeakable yearning. Late that summer, Yavin and Torm came to Venta with the father, and the division between family and slaves was again drawn deep by the presence of the family men. I went out one day seeking solitude. Among the forested hills south of the farmhouse, I found a beautiful oak grove in the fold of two hills. A clear stream ran down through it, and there was a strange little structure of rock halfway up the slope. A shrine, certainly, but to what god I did not know. I told Sallow about it, and she wanted to see it. So one afternoon I took her and Riss and Tib there. Tib saw nothing to interest him in the place. He was restless, and soon roamed off back to the farm. Riss and Sallow felt as I did, that there was some presence or blessing in the grove, the glade, the ruined altar. They settled down in the thin shade of the old oaks near the small, quick-running creek on what had once been a lawn around the shrine. Each of them had her drop spindle and a sack of cloudy wool, for they were at the age now when women were to be seen doing women's work wherever they were. That they could run off with me unguarded, not even asking permission, was part of the miraculous ease of life at Venta. Anywhere else, two house-slave girls of 14 would not have been allowed to leave the house at all. But they were good girls. They took their work with them, and the mother trusted them as she trusted the benevolence of the place. So we sat on the thin grass of the slope in the hot August shade, feeling the cool breath of the running water, and were silent for a long time, at peace, in freedom.
"I wonder if it was an altar to May,"
Riss said.
Sallow shook her head.
"It's not the right shape," she said.
"Who then?"
"Maybe some god that only lived here."
"An oak tree god," I said.
"That would be Aini."
"No,"
Sallow said, with unusual certainty.
"It isn't Aini. It was a god that was here. This place is god. It's spirit."
"What should we leave as an offering?"
Riss asked, half serious, half joking.
"I don't know," Sallow said. "We'll find out."
Riss spun a while, the motion of her arm and hand graceful and hypnotic. Riss was not as pretty as Sallow, but calm and charming in her ripening womanhood, with a splendid mane of glossy black hair and a dreamy look in her long eyes. She heaved a quiet sigh and said,
"I don't ever want to leave here."
She would be given in a couple of years. probably to young Odirin Adir, possibly to the heir of Haramand, wherever the interests and allegiances and debts of Arca indicated. We all knew that. The slave girls had been brought up to be given. Rhys trusted her house to give her where she would be valued and well-treated. She had no dread, and a good deal of lively curiosity about where and to whom she would be sent. I'd heard her and Sallow talking about it. Sallow would not be given away from our house. She was destined for Yavin. That was equally well known. But at Archimand, daughters of the family were not married off early, and slave girls were not given at 13 or 14, even if they were physically mature. Iamur repeated the mother's words to our girls.
A woman is healthier and lives longer if she has had time to grow into her womanhood and does not bear children while she is still a child.
And Avera quoted Trudic in approval.
Let a maiden remain a maiden until she be full grown and have wisdom, for the worship of a virgin daughter is most pleasing to her ancestors.
And Sem, the hostler, said,
You don't breed a yearling filly, do you?
So Rhys wasn't speaking in imminent concern about having to leave home and learn how a gift girl was treated at a Deermand or Haramand, but only in the knowledge that within a few years she'd be sent into a new life, and seldom, if ever, see us, and almost certainly never know any such freedom as this again. Her unprotesting melancholy touched Sallow and me, safe as we were in knowing we would always live with our own family and people.
What would you do, Rhys?
My sister asked, looking across the stream into the warm, shadowy depths of the woods.
If you were set free.
They don't set girls free,
Rhys said, practical and accurate.
Only men who do something heroic. Like that tiresome slave who saved his master's treasure in the fables.
But there are countries where there aren't any slaves. If you lived there, you'd be free. Everybody is.
But I'd be a foreigner, Rhys said with a laugh. How do I know what I'd do? Crazy foreign things.
Well, but pretend. If you did get set free here, in Itra.
Rhys set herself to think about it.
If I was a freed woman, I could get married, so I could keep my own babies. But I'd have to look after them myself, whether I wanted to or not, wouldn't I? I don't know. I don't know any freed women. I don't know what it's like. What would you do?
I don't know,
Sallow said.
I don't know why I think about it, but I do.
It would be nice to be married,
Rhys said after a while, thoughtfully.
So that you knew.
I did not know what she meant.
Oh, yes,
Sallow said, heartfelt.
But you do know, Sal. Yavindi wouldn't ever pass you around.
No. He wouldn't,
Sallow said, and there was a tenderness in her voice, as always when she spoke of Yavin, and a proud embarrassment. I understood now that Rhys had meant a master's power to give away the girl he'd been given, or lend her out to other men, or send her to the women's quarters to nurse other women's babies, whatever he pleased, a power she had no part in, but must simply submit to. Thinking about that made me feel extremely lucky to be a man. So in turn I was a little embarrassed when Sallow asked me,
What would you do, Gav?
If I was set free? She nodded, looking at me with that same loving tenderness and pride, but no embarrassment, only a little teasing. I thought a while and said, Well, I'd like to travel. I'd like to go to Maesun, where the university is. And I'd like to see Pagadi. And maybe the ruins of Sentos. and cities you read about, like Resfa of the Towers and Ansel the Beautiful, with 4 canals and 15 bridges. And then? Then I'd come back to Archimand with a lot of new books. Teacher D won't even talk about getting any new books.
Oldest is safest, I mouthed froggily, imitating Avera being pompous.
Riss and Sallow giggled. And that was all our conversation on a freedom we could not imagine. Nor did we leave any offering to the spirit of that place, unless remembrance is a kind of offering. The following summer, our stay at the farm was cut short by rumors of war. We arrived there as usual, with the cousins from Harrowmand, and on the first evening, all 9 of us went out to Centaur's Hill, expecting to find it in ruins again. But though the winter rains had damaged the moat and earthworks, the walls and towers stood, and had even been built higher in places. Some of the farm children must have taken it over and made it their own refuge or play fortress. Yumo and Uter were indignant, feeling our Centaur had been invaded, polluted. But Astano said, "Maybe it will always be here now." Oko and Yumo were the only ones who worked much that summer at cleaning out the moat and strengthening the earthworks and palisade. Astano and Sotur were kept with the women much of the time, and the rest of us dispersed on our own pursuits. Tib and I swam and fished. Sallow and I went back to the Oak Grove shrine when she could get away from the house, with Riss or by ourselves. And I made an unexpected friend. I had been giving the little girls a hand at bracing up the palisade at Centaur's, and was coming home through the vineyard in the heat of the day, crickets shrilling and cicadas rasping far and near in the trance of light and heat. A vineyard worker was coming towards me down another row. I glimpsed him now and then between the high vines, on which the grape clusters were just beginning to swell. As we passed each other, he stopped and said, "Dee." It was how the country people spoke to a master, not by name, merely with the honorific. Surprised, I stopped and peered at him around the long-armed vine. I recognized him, Komi, the boy who had led the Jenny when we climbed to the summit of the hills, and who had sung that evening. He looked much older. I would have taken him for a grown man. He had a sparse stubble of beard, and his face was hard and bony. I said his name. He was clearly surprised and gratified that I knew him. He stood silent a while, and then said, "Hope it was all right what we did at the rock place." "It was fine," I said. "It was some of Meriv's fellows knocked it down last year." "It's all right. It's just a game." I didn't know what to say to this grim fellow. His accent was hard for me to understand. I could smell his stale sweat, though we were 4 or 5 feet apart. He was barefoot, and his dark calloused feet stood in the earth like the vine roots. There was a long silence, and I was about to say goodbye and go on, when Komi said, "I can show you a good fishing place." I'd done a lot of fishing that summer. Tib and I heard that there were streams where the farm people caught salmon trout, though we'd never caught any. I said something to show my interest, and Komi said, "At the rock fort this evening," and went striding on down between the vines. Though I was dubious about the whole venture, I went back to Centaur's late in the afternoon, telling myself that if Komi didn't turn up, I could do a little more work for Oko and Yumo. But I saw him coming through the vineyard not long after I got there. I went down and joined him, and we went in silence up the creek at the hill's foot till it joined a larger stream, and then along that for a half mile or so on a thread of a path through willows and alders and laurels, till at the foot of a hill the water came down into deep basins where it flowed full and still among great smooth boulders. We each had our rudimentary fishing gear. In silence, we baited our lines and chose a boulder to stand on and cast out into the dark pools. It was a warm, still evening in the long days of the year, not yet sunset for an hour or so. The light filtered through the trees in soft, slanting shafts. Tiny flies dimpled the water's surface and flitted in the darkness under the banks. Within a minute, a fish rose to my line, and I brought it in by instinct or accident, a splendid rosy-spotted creature weighing 3 or 4 pounds. I hardly knew what to do with such a catch. I saw Comey's grin.
"Beginner's luck," he said,
throwing out his line again. As we stood there, casting and now and then catching, I felt a liking and gratitude to the silent youth who stood there on the rocks over the water, thin, raw-boned, enigmatic. I didn't know why he reached out to me across the ignorance and enmity that kept the farm people and the city people apart, or how he knew that we could make friends despite the enormous difference of our knowledge and experience. But we did. We said almost nothing, but in our silence there was trust. When the ruddy light had died away among the trees, we gathered up our catch. He had a net pouch, and I put my fish into it, the first grand big one and 2 smaller ones, along with the 2 he'd caught, 1 salmon trout and 1 thin, fierce-mouthed fish, a pikelet maybe. I followed him down the invisible path through the dusky woods and out at last into the vineyard. It was almost dark by then, even under the open sky. When we got to the road, I said, "Thanks, Comey." He nodded and stopped to give me my fish. "Keep them." He hesitated. "I can't cook them." He shrugged, and his smile flashed in the dusk. He muttered thanks and made off, vanishing almost at once in the twilight among the high vines with their reaching arms. After that, I went fishing with Comey several times, always at a different place. It was a little unnerving to realize that he always knew where I was, when he was free to find me and ask almost wordlessly if I wanted to go fishing that evening. I never brought Tib, never even told him of my expeditions with Comey. I felt that I had no right to. If Comey wanted Tib along, he would have asked him. I did tell Sallow about Comey, because I had no secrets from her. She liked hearing about him. When I puzzled at his choosing me for a companion and taking me to his prized fishing pools, she said,
"Well, he's lonely, probably, and he likes you."
How would he know he liked me?
"Seeing you that day we climbed the hills. And they see more of us than we do of them, I'm sure. He could tell, he could trust you."
"It's sort of like knowing a wolf," I said.
"I wish we could go to their village,"
my sister said.
"It seems so strange that we can't. Like they really were wild animals or something. Some of the women who come up to the farmhouse are relatives of the house people. They seem nice enough, only it's hard to understand what they say."
This put it into my head to ask Comey if I could go home with him sometime, for I, too, had always been curious about those dark houses down in the valley, even if our orchard wars and the ambush on the road had put us at odds with the farm people. So the next time Comey and I came up from the river in the twilight, I said, "I'll go on with you." We had a really good catch that night. Our prize, a monster salmon trout, as long as my forearm. Carrying it made a kind of excuse. He said nothing, and after a while I said, "Will they mind?" I think he had as much trouble figuring out what the words I used meant as I did with his dialect. He pondered and finally shrugged. We went on into the village. Smoke was rising from the chimneys of the longhouses and the cabins, and there were strong smells of cooking. Dark figures passed us in the rutted, dusty street that rambled among the houses, and dogs barked insistently. Comey turned aside not to a longhouse, as I had expected, but to one of the shambling cabins, built up on short poles to keep them from the winter mud. A man was sitting out on the wooden steps that led up to the door. I had seen him working in the vineyards. He and Comey greeted each other with a kind of grunt, and the man said,
"Who's that?"
"From the house," Comey said.
"Hey?"
the man said, startled, stiffening, ready to get up. I think he thought Comey had brought one of the family boys here and was terrified. Comey said something that identified me as a house slave and calmed the man down. He stared at me in silence. I felt extremely uncomfortable, but having come this far, didn't want to back out. I said, "May I come in?" Comey hesitated and gave his hunching shrug. He led me into the house. It was completely dark inside, except for the dim glow of a fire under heavy ashes in the hearth. There were people, women, an old man, some children, dark bulks crowded in the heavy air that smelled of human bodies and dogs and food and wood and earth and smoke. Comey took the big fish from me and gave it and our other catch to a woman whom I could see only as a bulky shadow and the flash of an eye. He and she said a word or two, and she turned to me.
"Do you want to eat with us then, Dee?"
Her voice seemed unfriendly, even sneering. Yet she waited for an answer. "No, Ma'io. I have to get home, thank you," I said.
"It's a grand fish,"
she said, holding up the big one. "Thanks, Comey," I said, backing out. "Luck and Enu bless the house." And I made off, intimidated and appalled and glad to get away, yet also glad I had gone so far. At least I had a little to tell Sallow. She guessed that it was a family in the cabin, that the man on the steps may have been Comey's father. She had gathered from talk among the farmhouse women that though, of course, there was no marriage, these country people commonly lived with their spouse and children, or sometimes spouses and children. It was all to the good of the farm if the slaves bred up more slaves who knew the work and the land and nothing else, whose whole life was in that dark village by the stream.
"I wish I could meet Comey again," Sallow said.
The next time he found me, I said, "Do you know the old altar in the oak grove?" He nodded. Of course he did. Comey knew every rock and tree and stream and field on the Venta farm and for miles around it. "Meet us there this evening," I said, "instead of fishing."
"Who's us?"
"My sister." He thought about it, gave his shrug nod, and went off. Sallow and I were there an hour or so before sunset. She sat with her spinning, the cloudy mass of fine-carded wool endlessly turning under her fingers to a gray-brown, even, endless thread. Comey appeared silently, coming up the little stream bed among the willow shrubs. She greeted him, and he nodded and sat down at some distance from us. She asked him if he was a vineyarder, and he said yes, and told us a little about the work, haltingly.
"Do you still sing, Comey?"
she asked, and he shrugged and nodded.
"Will you?"
As before, on the hilltop, he made no reply, and was silent for a long time. Then he sang, that same strange, high, soft singing that seemed to have no source or center, as if it did not come from a human throat, but hung in the air like the song of insects, wordless, but sad beyond all words. I planned to bring Sotur to the oak grove, maybe to hear Comey sing, maybe just to sit there with Sallow and me in the peace of the place. I could imagine what it would be like when Sotur was there, how she would go look at the altar and maybe know what god it belonged to, how she would go down to the little stream and maybe wade in it a bit to get cool, how she and Sallow would sit side by side, spinning and talking softly, laughing sometimes. I decided it would be best if Sallow asked her to come. Lately I wanted very much to talk to Sotur, but for some reason found it harder and harder to do so. and I put off asking Sallow to ask Sotur to come with us to the Oak Grove. I don't know why. Maybe because I had such pleasure in thinking about it, imagining it. And then it was too late. Sotur's brothers and Torm came riding from Itra all in haste and full of alarms and orders. We must pack up tonight and leave the farm first thing in the morning. Marauders from Votis had crossed the moor and burned the vineyards and orchards of Merto, a village not 10 miles south of Venta. They could be here at any moment. Torm was in his element, striding about, brusque and warlike. He ordered that the girls of the family sleep in the house, and we few who stayed outdoors got little sleep, for Torm kept pacing past us and around the house, keeping watch. Very early, before sunrise, the father himself rode in. He had been kept at civic duties until midnight, but his worry for us had not let him wait in the city. The morning was bright and hot. The farmhouse people worked hard with us to get everything packed and loaded, and called goodbye to us mournfully as the procession set off at last down the long hill road. The slaves at work in the fields glanced up as we passed, unspeaking. I looked for Comey, but saw no one I knew. The people of the farm would have to wait there, defenseless, in hope that the soldiers sent out from Itra would intercept the marauders. The father had reassured them that a large force had gone out, and would by now be between Merto and Venta, driving the Votizens back to the river. It was hot already, and dusty on the road. Torm, riding a nervous, foaming, sweating horse, harried the drivers with his shouts to speed up, move on, hurry. The father, jogging along beside the mother's chariot, said nothing to Torm to calm him down. The father had always been firm and stern with Yavin, but he seemed increasingly reluctant to chide Torm or even restrain him. Sallow and I talked about it as we walked. I thought he was afraid of sending Torm into one of his fury fits. Sallow nodded, but added, "Yavin isn't like his father. Torm is, at least in looks. He walks just like him now, just like Twinny does." That was pretty harsh talk for gentle Sallow, but she'd always disliked both Torm and Hobi. We shut up abruptly when we realized that Sotur Io had come up with us on foot and might have heard us discussing our father and his sons. Sotur said nothing, just walked along steadily with us, her face closed and frowning. I think she hadn't obtained permission to get down and walk, certainly not to walk with the slaves, but had escaped from the family, as she'd often done before. All she said to us, after we had walked a long way together in silence, was,
"Oh, Sallow, Gav, the summers are over."
And I saw tears in her eyes.